This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Stories. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says Israel's plan to normalize ties with the Arab world is doomed to failure since regional people oppose it. Students disrupt a speech by Israel's ambassador to Britain at Cambridge University's debate union. Will bring you a report. Plus, the Horn of Africa witnessing its worst drought in decades. The UN says 13 million people in Kenya, Somalia and Ethiopia are facing severe hunger. Welcome to the program. Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says Iran's foes cannot easily attack the country. In an interview with Iran's Al-Alam TV, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said it's not in the U.S. interest to attack Iran, as it cannot stop Tehran's peaceful nuclear activities. Nasrallah said he believes Israel's repeated threats in recent months to attack Iran's nuclear sites are all empty words, and the regime will not make the mistake of launching a war on Iran. Nasrallah said Tel Aviv knows if it strikes Iran, the response will be harsh, decisive, and precise. He said some Arab states that normalize ties with Iran, with Israel, cannot help the regime militarily. Nasrallah also touched on recent diplomatic contacts between Israel and some Arab states. He said Israel's plan to normalize ties with the Arab world is doomed to failure since people in the region oppose it.
In Bahrain, they will not be supportive of armaments. Even inside Saudi Arabia, the Saudi society are not with normalization of ties, even those who go on televisions. This is Egypt, this is Jordan, this is Northern Africa, Indonesia, Malaysia, Afghanistan, Iran, Pakistan, all the Arab and Islamic world.
Nasrallah said the regime's normalization efforts are mainly aimed at pushing Palestinians to a state of despair so they accept defeat and give up on their cause to liberate their lands. He said Palestinians will resist such plots as they're brave and steadfast. On the U.S. sanctions on Hezbollah, Nasrallah said such measures will not have a major impact on the resistance movement. He said the U.S. sanctions war cannot stop Hezbollah's growth and development. Nasrallah also referred to Yemen's recent retaliatory strikes against the UAE. He said Abu Dhabi had to plead for help from Western countries following the attacks. Nasrallah said such attacks will continue until the UAE and Saudi Arabia stop their aggression against the people of Yemen. Iran says it is ready to reach, in the shortest possible time, a good agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. The comment was made by the Iranian foreign minister, who spoke with his Russian counterpart on the phone. Hossein Amir Abdullahian, however, noted that for a speedy agreement, the West needs not only to be realistic, but also take real and concrete measures. He also stressed that Iran is resolutely seeking a good agreement within the framework of its interests and rights. Meanwhile, Sergei Lavrov stressed the importance of removing anti-Iran sanctions, urging all parties, especially the U.S., to return to their commitments under the JCPOA. This comes as Tehran and the remaining signatories to the deal resumed talks in the Austrian capital on Tuesday in a bid to revive the accord. Our correspondent Homa Lezgi joined us earlier from Vienna with more details about the ongoing talks between Iran and the remaining signatories of the 2015 deal.
The Russian ambassador, Mr. Ulyanov, in one interview just ahead of the resumption of the eighth round, said that almost all of the work on the final text has been done and that he believes that we can reasonably assume that things can move forward and a successful conclusion can be achieved by the end of the month or early March, that being seen now as a potential informal deadline, so to speak, although none of the participants, as we have said before, accept any official or, in their words, artificial deadlines for these talks. But the Americans, the Europeans, have been making it clear that they also believe that a deal or an agreement is in sight, but that if it doesn't happen in the next week, then there'll be no point in dragging out these talks. The Iranian side says that we are willing to continue talks as long as necessary, and that takes us to the issues that are still up for negotiation in these talks, specifically when it comes to the scope of sanctions lifting. It seems like there are still discussions on the sanctions that Iran wants to be removed. It says, as the Supreme National Security Council also made it clear, just ahead of these talks, it says that it wants all of the Trump-era sanctions to be removed, all of those imposed as part of the maximum pressure campaign. Some of those have other labels. They're not officially related to the nuclear issue, but Iranians say, of course, that they are effectively and on the ground going to stop the effective implementation of the JCPOA and create concern for third parties. Also, when it comes to the issue of sequencing, Iranians have said that they want the verified and effective removal of sanctions before they go back to their commitments. And of course, when it comes to, again, the issue of sanctions, verification and guarantees, it looks like there are still issues to be discussed there. Iran saying that it wants legal, political and economic guarantees that the sanctions will be effectively removed. And also, as you know, that the Americans will not withdraw from the JCPOA again.
Islamabad has asked the Taliban in Afghanistan not to allow their soil to be used by terrorists. This after at least five Pakistani soldiers lost their lives in a cross-border attack. As Kamran Youssef reports from Islamabad, since the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan, there has been a surge in the militant attacks in Pakistan.
Pakistan has laid to rest its soldiers killed in a recent terrorist attack. Over the past 2 weeks, at least 22 Pakistani security officials and soldiers have lost their lives in multiple terrorist attacks. In one such attack along the Afghan border, at least five Pakistani soldiers were killed. Pakistan has blamed militants based in Afghanistan for the attacks. It has issued a strong statement urging the interim Afghan government not to allow militants to use the Afghan soil against Pakistan in the future. Pakistan has publicly condemned the use of Afghan soil for the first time since the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan in August.
Afghan Taliban will have to rethink their position. They need to rethink how they think about the TTP, you know, because a terrorist outfit, if it continues to inflict terror, you know, wounds in Pakistan, will not be tolerated by Pakistan.
The Taliban government spokesperson has denied Pakistani allegations and insisted it has no evidence to suggest the recent attacks originated from the neighboring country.
Pakistan hopes that cross-border as well as terrorist raids would end under the Taliban rule in Afghanistan. but the number of such attacks has gone up instead. This has raised concerns in Islamabad that the Afghan Taliban either does not have what it takes or is unwilling to act against militant groups.
Back in November last year, a ceasefire was brokered between Islamabad and pro-Taliban militants based in Pakistan. But the truce ended with both sides accusing the other for not fulfilling their promises.
The doors for the negotiation can never be shut. But terrorists and those who raise arms against the Pakistan army and against Pakistan and attack our installations and our camps, they will not be forgiven.
Observers believe that Pakistan's relationship with the interim government in Afghanistan could come under serious stress if the cross-border militant attacks are continued. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Israel's ambassador to Britain has been met with a protest by university students after she was invited to speak at Cambridge University's debate union. Though her talk in Cambridge did go on, so did protests outside the venue. Robert Carter was there on the scene.
Students and activists gathered outside England's Cambridge University on Tuesday to voice their anger after Israel's ambassador to Britain, Tzipi Hotovili, was invited to debate at the prestigious Cambridge Union Debate Hall.
So, once again, the ambassador finds a significant protest following her outside the university venue where she is speaking. It's not the first time, and it probably won't be the last. These protesters have made absolutely clear that they consider her to be a racist and a fascist.
Despite the police presence, activists made noise, lit flares, and eventually blocked the car park entrance, disrupting the ambassador's ability to leave. Protesters told Press TV why they were so furious.
To be Jewish is not to be blindly nationalistic. Israel doesn't represent Jews. Just like I don't represent all Jews, I represent myself, and I represent some Jews.
This is the Israeli ambassador to the UK, and they didn't choose someone who was a moderate. They choose someone who is a representation of the Israeli state at the moment, a fascist apartheid state, as testified to by Amnesty International. Someone who believes in the ethnic superiority of one race over the other, which Hotovili does believe, and the sustenance of that through ethnic cleansing and settlements, because she was formerly settlements minister, is something that we should all be demonstrating against.
Back in November 2021, Hotovili was similarly met with protests after speaking at an event at the London School of Economics. Home Secretary Priti Patel was among several pro-Israel MPs who rushed to condemn the incident, despite police saying it was not under investigation. As she left Cambridge, again she was booed and jeered, leaving some wondering if she'll again try to accuse students of anti-Semitism, despite the fact Jews, as well as Muslims and Christians, were among the demonstrators' ranks. Robert Carter, Cambridge.
The UN World Food Programme says millions of people in countries across the Horn of Africa are facing severe hunger as the region witnesses its worst drought in two decades.
After three failed rainy seasons, the Horn of Africa is in the midst of a severe drought affecting up to 13 million people. Southern Ethiopia, northern Kenya and Somalia are impacted, livestock are dying, crops are failing and populations are being forced from their homes.
Nearly 6 million people are in need of food assistance in southern Ethiopia alone. That includes 500,000 malnourished children in Somalia, the UN agency says. The number of people in need of food aid will rise to nearly 5 million by May if immediate action is not taken. Another 2.8 million people in Kenya require assistance as authorities there declared a drought emergency in September of last year. The UN agency says the situation needs measures to avoid a repeat of a famine that killed hundreds of thousands of people a decade ago. The WFP says it needs nearly $330 million to respond to urgent needs over the next 6 months. Now, the busiest land crossing between the U.S. and Canada remains shut as Canadian truckers continue blocking roads in protest at the government's coronavirus measures. Trucks and other vehicles have blocked the lanes, causing gridlock for 2 days now. The so-called Freedom Convoy began as a movement against the vaccine requirement for cross-border truckers. The movement soon morphed into protests against public health measures and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's government. On Monday, Parliament held an emergency session to deal with the issue. Addressing the session, Trudeau demanded an end to the demonstrations, which have been ongoing for 2 days. Meanwhile, New Zealand witnessed a protest inspired by demonstrations in Canada, with hundreds of people blocking the road to the Parliament building. Earlier, we spoke to political commentator Mr. Edward Corrigan to get his thoughts on the truckers' protests in Canada. He believes the demonstrations are the result of a campaign by right-wing parties that is also attracting people with other grievances.
90% of the truckers actually are fully vaccinated. In Ontario, approximately 90% of the population is fully vaccinated. And the complaint that the truckers have is in some respect, I think, misguided, because they want to have an open border that they are exempt from having vaccinations and having to report. Now, it's the United States government that has the rule that prevents Canadian truckers from leaving Canada and going into the United States. And Canada has the same rule where American truckers who come into Canada have to be fully vaccinated and have documentation to back that up. So the Canadian truckers, you know, they're sort of, I think, banging on the door very loudly, but they're banging on the wrong door, and I don't think they can change anything. Partly because there's a right-wing party that is putting its resources behind this the Freedom Convoy and the anti-vaxxer campaign. So there is a bit of a political organization that is supplanting and increasing the numbers. It also has become, you know, I guess, a magnet for attracting people with other complaints. You see, you know, actually in some of the convoys, we see, you know, United States Confederate flags, you know, a lot of attacks on, on Trudeau and the government. So it's become, you know, and people are frustrated, they're tired, and they want this to end. But I think, you know, to end it prematurely is would be a mistake.
NATO announces plans to ensure a larger permanent presence of its forces in Eastern Europe. Critics say the move is designed to further provoke Russia. Jerome Hughes is in Brussels.
We are closest allies and working.
In recent days, a series of separate delegations from the EU have traveled to the United States, Ukraine, and Russia as tensions between the West and Moscow show no sign of abating. The Kremlin insists the security of Russian citizens is paramount, and therefore Ukraine cannot be allowed to join NATO. On Monday, the head of the 30-nation alliance confirmed additional NATO forces have been moved to Eastern Europe, and there's a plan to make that permanent.
There is a process now going on within NATO, also, of course, in close consultation with our military commanders, to adjust our presence in the eastern part of the alliance.
Peace activists claim NATO is being unnecessarily provocative.
We would have a lot of advantages only with one symbolical sentence, not to expand with Ukraine and Georgia. And then Putin would be satisfied, and you can make agreements with him.
The EU is sending huge amounts of money to Kiev.
More than 17 billion euros.
Even though the bloc's own agencies say Ukraine is corrupt at the highest levels, EU citizens are worried the situation could exacerbate the bloc's energy crisis, given that we import so much from Russia.
Putting in danger European gas supplies. So this is really frightening to me personally. And I think the whole European population should be frightened about this.
That could be a solution for the energy crisis. Everybody just spend less money on army and more money on compensation kind of energy support for the people.
A number of political commentators say some senior figures in the EU and NATO believe the West is pushing Russia a bit too far. Double standards and hypocrisy are at play, according to impartial foreign policy analysts.
They remind us the United States has approximately 800 military bases in 80 nations around the world. This as Russia is vilified for moving troops within its own borders. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
There is little U.S. media coverage of the disgraceful acts of the Zionist regime against Palestinians. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Ron Fulfair Ryder. This article is published under the heading U.S. Corporate Media and Zionist Regime. Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime is greatly concerned about the Palestinian boycott, divestment and sanctions effort, that is BDS, that seeks to end international support for the Zionist regime's oppression of Palestinians and to pressure the Israeli regime to comply with international law. The Zionist regime claims that this campaign is a threat to its legitimacy. Unsurprisingly, the Zionist regime doesn't want to acknowledge that it is its own repeated flouting of international law, including its numerous war crimes that threaten its legitimacy. Given the Zionist regime's misperception, it is waging a campaign to limit any discussion about its illegal and immoral actions. Unfortunately, even without the Zionist regime's campaign, the U.S. corporate media already aids the Israeli regime through its lack of coverage or its downplaying the effects of Israeli violations. For example, there is limited coverage of the desperate conditions in Gaza under a seldom-mentioned illegal Israeli siege. The major Zionist regime attacks on Gaza in 2008, 2012, and 2014 also greatly damaged hospitals, the sanitation system, and other infrastructure, schools, and apartment buildings in Gaza. This siege has made it nearly impossible to bring in materials and supplies to repair the devastation. These Israeli regime war crimes and the siege have combined to make life a living hell for approximately 2 million people surviving in the Gaza Strip. In addition, the frequent criminal behavior of the illegal Israeli regime occupiers of Palestinian land in the West Bank is rarely reported. The Zionist regime military and police seldom arrest these illegal occupiers, sometimes allowing the criminal behavior to continue and sometimes being complicit in the crimes. Moreover, the Zionist regime has destroyed and continues to destroy Palestinian homes in the West Bank, including East Al-Quds. The Zionist regime uses very questionable excuses as a pretext to illegally remove more and more Palestinians from their homes. There is also little media coverage of the disgraceful arrest and imprisonment of Palestinian children. The corporate-controlled media also downplayed the finding that the Zionist regime is an apartheid regime by the Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem, as well as by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. The U.S. corporate media's coverage of the Zionist regime's acts against U.S. interests leaves much to be desired. One of the most blatant and poorly covered actions was the Zionist regime's attempt in 1967 to sink the USS Liberty, a lightly armed intelligence gathering ship. This attack killed 34 and wounded 171 U.S. sailors. Spies for Israel, that is Jonathan Pollard, greatly damaged U.S. interests. In 1987, Caspar Weinsberger, then U.S. Secretary of War, stated, "It is difficult for me to conceive of a greater harm to national security than that caused by the defendant in view of the breadth, the critical importance to the U.S. and the high sensitivity of the formation he sold to Israel." Concerning Pollard, Seymour Hersh, a Pulitzer Prize winner, wrote that some in the U.S. intelligence community believed that the Zionist regime shared much of the information with the Soviet Union. On another front, in the early 1990s, then-CIA director James Woolsey told a Senate Government Affairs Committee that the Zionist regime had been selling U.S. secrets to other countries for about a decade. These sales have continued at least through 2013. In addition to the media complicity, Israeli regime supporters have mounted campaigns in universities and at the state and national levels that attempt to suppress supporters of Palestinian anti-occupation activism and BDS. In 2015, the Palestine Legal Center and the Center for Constitutional Rights issued a report documenting widespread attempts to stifle the free speech of Palestinian supporters in the U.S. There are also international efforts to ban support for BDS or opposition to the Zionist regime's occupation of Palestinian lands. Fortunately, the American Civil Liberties Union helped stop legislation in Congress that would have silenced criticism of the Zionist regime. Unfortunately, too many politicians have been willing to stifle free speech. As of 2021, 35 states have passed bills or executive orders designed to discourage boycotts of the Zionist regime. Given the Zionist regime's damning record, it's clear why it would want to limit free speech on its policies. In particular, if Americans understood the depth of the Zionist regime's war crimes and gross human rights violations, it would be hard to continue to support U.S. vetoes of U.N. Security Council resolutions against these crimes. Moreover, it would be difficult to rationalize the U.S. providing almost $4 billion in military aid annually to the Zionist regime, a wealthy regime that has long had one of the world's strongest militaries.
Hearty congratulations to all our listeners on the 43rd 10-day dawn celebrations marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Syria, the case of a crisis.
Thank you very much for waiting.
At the end of 2013, efforts to find a political solution to resolve the crisis in Syria escalated. Lakhdar Brahimi, the UN Secretary General's special envoy, was able to convince Bashar Assad to negotiate with the opposition. The Syrian government, in light of victories achieved with the help of Iran and Hezbollah, was in a better situation than the past and would be able to take part in peace talks with a stronger stance.
Syria is now undoubtedly the most serious crisis.
Even though Lakhdar Brahimi announced that the Syrian government and the opposition would hold talks in Geneva, serious problems existed in the path of the success of the talks. The most important problem was, who was going to be representing the opposition to negotiate with the Syrian government? The National Syrian Council, which was known as the political opposition, didn't have much control over the battlefield and couldn't decide for extremist Salafi groups.
Do the Syrian opposition who go to Geneva represent the opposition? Which opposition are you talking about? Daesh and Nusra, the main fighters among the opposition, were not at these peace conferences. Nor were they invited. Nor did they have a ceasefire. And they had little ceasefires with Nusra, but that's different. I think the official opposition, as we in the West regard them, as opposed to the Assad official opposition, I don't know if they represent many people anymore.
The next problem was that the U.S. and Western countries still insisted on their position that Assad has to step aside, and this position was not acceptable to the Syrian government and its supporters.
We believe that President Assad has lost the legitimacy necessary to be able to be a cohesive force that could bring people together.
At the time, Iran, as one of the influential sides on the political spectrum in Syria, expressed a desire to be present in the process of resolving the political crisis.
Iran will attend the Geneva II talks if invited. We believe that Iran's presence in those talks are useful, will contribute to a resolution.
The United Nations also welcomed the initiative.
That Iran would play a positive and constructive role in Montreux. Therefore, as convener and host of the conference, I have decided to issue an invitation to Iran to participate.
But the invitation was faced with the opposition's reaction.
Iran has not satisfied the minimum requirement for this invitation, and we thank the Secretary General for accepting the letter that was sent by the head of the National Coalition, Mr. Ahmed Al-Jarba, in this regard.
The U.S. government put pressure on the UN to withdraw the invitation, and in the end, the pressures were successful.
The Secretary General is deeply disappointed by Iranian public statements today that are not at all consistent with that stated commitment. He continues to urge Iran to join the global consensus behind the Geneva communique. He has decided that the one-day Montreux gathering will proceed without Iran's participation.
In January 2014, talks between the Syrian government and opposition forces took place in the city of Geneva, with international players in attendance. And, as it was anticipated, the participants only insisted on the conditions they had in mind.
That means that Bashar Assad will not be part of that transition government. There is no way possible in the imagination that the man who has led the brutal response to his own people could regain the legitimacy to govern. One man and those who have supported him can no longer hold an entire nation and a region hostage.
The inconclusive Geneva II meeting showed the Syrian conflict was not ready to be resolved with a political solution. At the time, the two sides of the conflict were almost balanced, and both still had hopes of victory. That's why one side of the war had to first substantially improve its position on the battlefields to be able to force the other side to accept its conditions to end the conflict. Because of this, even though Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey had disagreements over the Muslim Brotherhood, they agreed that they would unite the extremist Salafi groups affiliated with them. At the beginning of 2014, the Islamic Front was officially formed with the coalition of a number of leading armed groups in Syria. Since each of these groups was active in a different part of Syria, the Islamic Front covered almost all of the country, and these groups did not engage in parallel conflicts. On the other side, the Iranians also felt that with the existing forces, the likelihood of a strategic victory was impossible. The presence of Hezbollah had prevented the fall of the Syrian government, but the power of Hezbollah and the Syrian army was not enough to change the equations on the battlefield. In this situation, a war of attrition was underway which could not last long. Aside from the extensive support of foreigners from the Islamic Front, Daesh was also advancing from Syria's east fast, and this had caused the situation to become more difficult. That's why the IRGC decided to send its forces to Syria as well. Until then, Iran's presence was more in the role of commanding and managing popular defense forces. But at the beginning of 2014, Iranian forces slowly began going to Syria to fight alongside the exhausted Syrian army. But Iran sent its troops to Syria in limited numbers. Even though the IRGC had the capability of sending many of its forces to Syria and was able to change the equation of the battle. Because of such issues, IRGC officials tried to pave the way for the presence of non-Iranian forces. Therefore, fighters from Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan went to Syria to fight alongside the Syrian army against extremist Salafi groups. Because a part of the reason these forces were present in Syria was to defend Shia holy places, they became known as defenders of the holy shrine. Despite Iran's efforts to strengthen the Syrian army, the rise of Daesh changed all equations. In mid-2014, Daesh's advances in Syria's eastern provinces continued. The group was able to take the provinces of Raqqa and large parts of Deir ez-Zor and reach the suburbs of the city of Aleppo. Because of the oil and gas wells in the north of Deir ez-Zor province and Hasaka, Daesh's control over these areas provided the group with a good source of income.
Turkey has been one of the main sources of income for the Islamic State by purchasing oil illicitly on the black market at what we might call bargain prices, and in that way, indirectly funding the rise of the Islamic State.
But the successes of this group were not limited to Syria. In June 2014, it was announced that Daesh had taken over complete control of the city of Mosul. Mosul is Iraq's second most populated city and is strategically very important. Apparently, the betrayal of the city's security officials and disagreements among a number of Sunni leaders in Iraq with Maliki's government paved the way for Daesh's fast takeover of Mosul. To consolidate its power, Daesh executed a large number of Iraqi government forces in the city. The ultimate crime committed by the group was the massacre of 1,700 cadets at Camp Spiker. The publication of the clips of these crimes caused fear and panic among the residents of other Iraqi cities. The same public panic expedited Daesh's dominance over other cities. A few days later, the spokesman for Daesh officially announced the establishment of the Islamic Caliphate in an audio message. After the announcement of the Caliphate, Daesh was able to increase its power. Some people joined this group out of fear, and others because of financial reasons. Principally, most of Daesh's fighters were members of Saddam's disbanded army who had lost their jobs after the fall of the dictator. Aside from this, psychological and social circumstances existed in Iraq, which caused a part of the people to accept Daesh's way of thinking. The circumstances had been created when the U.S. invaded Iraq.
When you see what happened after the Americans came to Iraq, and I was in Iraq, when you saw the bodies coming to the mortuary, or the heads without bodies, I said, something has gone terribly wrong here. Some terrible anger was burning inside. I went to a mosque in Fallujah in 2003, 2004, and they were selling videotapes. So I bought some. What are these? I took them back to Baghdad, put them in the video player, and they were all pictures, film, of Russian soldiers being beheaded in Chechnya. Yeah. They were teaching films to teach Iraqis how to cut throats, you see? And they were being sold outside the mosque. This was ISIS, this was Daesh, long before we ever heard the word Daesh. Their fury was bound to produce something terrible like Daesh. That's not an excuse for Daesh, and it's a cult, it's madness, but I'm not surprised it exists. The more you beat people, the more injustice people suffer, the more these black flowers will come out of the ground. You didn't need a country to produce it, to help it with money, weapons, yes, but not to produce it.
It was obvious that Daesh was after reconstructing Iraq's tribal system and eliminating the country's minorities. At this time, Daesh killed a large number of Ezadis and Kurds and were warning Shias that when they reach Shia-dominated cities, they will destroy them too. From the north, Daesh forces were advancing toward Erbil, the capital of Iraq's Kurdistan region, and from the south, they had reached the suburbs of Baghdad. They were so close that they could target Baghdad's airport with mortars. The threat on Baghdad and the siege of Samarra, which is the holy resting place of two Shia imams, created sensitivity among Iranians. The increase in the power of Daesh in Iraq, aside from the threat on holy Shia places, could also pose a direct threat to Iran's borders.
If there are terrorist groups in an adjacent territory, and they're in Iraq in this case for Iran, and those terrorist groups pose a threat to, in this case, to Iran, then Iran does have a direct interest and, in practice, a right to get involved in dealing with that threat.
To prevent the fall of Baghdad, aside from directly sending arms and forces, Iran asked its regional allies for help as well. The IRGC decided to prevent Daesh from conquering the city of Erbil with the help of Peshmerga Kurdish forces. But Iran's help was only enough to slow the advance of Daesh, and a faster way to liberate the occupied areas had to be found. At the time, because of political disagreements in the country, the Iraqi army did not have the power nor the motivation needed to fight against Daesh's powerful forces. That's why the IRGC decided to implement a plan for popular mobilizations in Iraq as well. They had already established popular defense forces in Syria, but because of the weak religious beliefs among Syria's Alawites, they did not achieve the expected results. But the situation in Iraq was different. A large number of Iraqi youths volunteered to join the war against Daesh. Slowly, the initial core of Iraq's popular mobilization forces, known as Hashd al-Shaabi, was formed, and the Iranian officers took charge of training and organizing them. Even though most of the volunteer forces were made up of Shias, there was no religious limitation to take part, and Sunni, Christian, and even Ezadi battalions were also formed. Popular mobilization forces came into action, the main battle to take back Daesh-occupied cities began. In mid-2014, Daesh had become the main player in the crisis in Syria and was able to disrupt the balance of power. With the arrival of Daesh, three sides were now fighting the war in Syria. Daesh closed the path to any kind of cooperation with opposition forces, even those who had a close ideology with them. Therefore, it was fighting Salafi groups affiliated with Al-Qaeda and the Syrian army at the same time. Since Daesh had entered Syria from the east, the provinces it shared with Iraq, like Deir ez-Zor, Hasaka, and Raqqa, fell first. Before this, Syria's eastern provinces were under the control of the opposition. That's why they accused the Syrian government of supporting Daesh. But the emergence of Daesh in Syria created the opportunity for some Salafi extremist groups to be officially recognized by the international community. At the time, different secular groups were recognized by the West as moderate opponents, but did not have a presence on the battlefield. On the other hand, many European countries were looking for a way to limit Daesh's activities without sending their military forces. Even though the popular mobilization forces were in charge of battling Daesh in Iraq, and the implementation of the same formula was possible in Syria, Western countries believed supporting the popular mobilization forces and Hezbollah meant the reinforcement of Iran's influence in the region. So groups affiliated with Al-Qaeda and Salafi movements were focused on again. But because of the track record of these groups, introducing them as moderate opposition groups was unacceptable to the public. That's why some of these groups began the process of changing their nature. After the Nusra Front, Ahrar al-Sham was the most powerful group in the north and east of Syria. Ahrar al-Sham had close ties with Al-Qaeda, so much so that Ayman al-Zawahiri had charged one of his experienced men named Abu Khalid al-Suri with training and organizing the Ahrar al-Sham forces. With the assassination of Abu Khalid al-Suri by Daesh, Ahrar al-Sham was the first group to decide to use the situation to change its nature to gain international support, a decision which was backed by Turkey and Qatar. This group initially issued a statement called the Revolutionary Honor Pact, in which it announced its cooperation with other opposition groups in Syria and honoring the results of democratic elections in the country. A while later, the leaders of Ahrar al-Sham went a step further and dismissed the Salafi jihadi ideology. Muhammad al-Shami, the deputy of the leadership of the group, officially apologized that they had followed the Salafi jihadi ideology. Now, everyone was waiting to see how Ahrar al-Sham would continue its cooperation with other groups, such as the Nusra Front, now that it had changed its position. But what happened totally changed the situation. A week after the group's new stance, Ahrar al-Sham announced that its entire leadership council had been killed in an explosion. Ahrar al-Sham did not announce any more details about the incident. Later on, it was said that the leadership council was holding a meeting in one of the group's secret and underground headquarters in the suburbs of Idlib when a bomb exploded and killed all of them. Ambiguities about the blast lingered on, especially when images of the totally intact bodies of the commanders of Ahrar al-Sham weakened the possibility of their deaths in an explosion. Ahrar al-Sham's new leaders did not take a position on changing the nature of their movement so they could continue their cooperation with other Salafi extremist groups. After Ahrar al-Sham, the most important option to be introduced as moderate opposition forces was the Salafi group Jaish al-Islam, or Army of Islam. Jaish al-Islam, under the leadership of Zahran Alush, was based in the outskirts of Damascus and the Duma region. The movement was being backed by Saudi Arabia, and because it was close to the capital, it was the most important threat to Bashar Assad's political base, meaning the capital Damascus. Alush was able to attract a lot of financial and military support because of his harsh anti-Daesh positions and turned into a prominent figure in the Syrian conflict. Despite these threats and the unsuitable situation of the country, Bashar Assad decided to hold the first presidential election under the new constitution. Based on the new constitution, political figures who were living in the country for the past 10 years were able to become candidates for the race. The candidates also had to get the approval of 25 members of the parliament. Among the people who were running against Bashar Assad, only two had the required qualifications and were approved to run. The election would be held in areas under the control of the Syrian army. Opponents of Bashar Assad strongly opposed the election from the very beginning. They believed Assad's victory was certain and that would strengthen his legitimacy. Some European countries, like Germany and France, announced that they would not allow the election to be held in Syrian embassies in their country. But it was the Americans who took the harshest stance.
The elections are non-elections. The elections are a great big zero. They're meaningless. And they're meaningless because you can't have an election where millions of your people don't even have an ability to vote, where they don't have an ability to contest the election, and they have no choice.
Despite all the opposition and positions taken, the election took place as scheduled. Syrian government media organizations reported on the widespread participation of the people at the ballot boxes. The interesting point was the widespread voter turnout of displaced Syrians in Lebanon. Participation in Lebanon was so high that for hours traffic in Beirut was paralyzed and Syria's embassy extended the voting for a full day. 2 days later, the results were announced, which were almost as expected. Even though Bashar Assad was legally elected president, the election did not have any influence on resolving the crisis in Syria. Countries that supported the opposition kept insisting on the change in the Syrian government. Therefore, the battlefields would decide the political future of the country. In 2014, Israel revealed its relations with the Salafi group, the Nusra Front. From the beginning of the Syrian crisis, there were constantly rumors of Israel supporting opposition forces. The connection became known when extremist Salafi groups took over the city of Quneitra. This city is situated in the south of Syria, neighboring the occupied Golan Heights. Quneitra was among the cities which were designated as demilitarized zone by the UN, and the domination of Salafi groups on the city would not be possible without the cooperation of the Israeli army, which was on the other side of the border. Slowly, images emerged of injured Nusra Front fighters who had been transferred to hospitals in occupied Palestine for treatment. The revelation of the support that the Israeli military was providing the opposition affiliated with Al-Qaeda resulted in the reaction of the Golan population. Most of the inhabitants of the Golan Heights are ethnic Druze. Even though the Golan Heights have been occupied by Israel for years, the Druze in this region consider themselves Syrian and are supporters of Bashar Assad. As extremist Salafis consider the Druze infidels, their presence in the border areas was a threat to the local inhabitants there. The youths of this region even attacked an Israeli military ambulance which was transferring injured Nusra Front militants and killed its occupants. Even though the Israeli military vowed to crack down on the perpetrators, it was evident that it was not after increasing tensions with the local population. Especially since there were signs that Hezbollah was working on forming resistance groups in the southern regions of Syria.
The Limelight.
Biden has chosen the worst of all paths, further escalation by deploying troops without any real capabilities, all while distracting from more important issues of national security, says Bradley Delvin, staff reporter for the American Conservative, in an article titled Biden's Pointless Troop Deployment. Stay tuned for more. President Joe Biden has decided to deploy 3,000 U.S. troops to Eastern Europe, adding to fears a war amidst a Russian troop buildup along the borders of Ukraine. The U.S. president's move was heralded by members of the foreign policy establishment in both parties, while those still focused on preventing war with Russia over a country insignificant to U.S. interest were smeared with accusations of spreading disinformation. Critics say the president's troop deployment offers no strategic advantage to the United States regime, while needlessly increasing tensions. Recently, the Biden administration announced about 1,000 U.S. troops will be moved from bases in Germany to Romania, which shares a border with Ukraine, to reinforce America's existing presence there.